And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, it's Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, the April 19th, 2018 edition. 2 hours of mostly me, but some of other folks too. So stay tuned, and away we'll go.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to begin this broadcast by looking at the Indie Bay calendar, and if you want, just go check it out yourself. That's at Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, for a couple of events coming up in the next few days. So the first thing I note is that actually while you're listening to this broadcast, in less than an hour at 7 o'clock at the Capitola City Hall, 420 Capitola Avenue, Capitola, there's going to be a meeting of the Harm Reduction Coalition, a group that's been holding a number of listening sessions at different places, and I'll read a little bit from stories in the Sentinel and the City on a Hill Press. The controversial idea of providers meeting drug users where they're at with clean needles and opioid overdose antidotes is gathering steam. The group, the Harm Reduction Coalition of Santa Cruz County, forged during a March 19th community meeting, aims to bring together health service providers, elected officials, law enforcement, and community members to advocate for continuing and improved public health policies and programs to provide clean drug paraphernalia, hepatitis C treatment, HIV testing, Narcan distribution. And now here comes the rub. This kind of stuff has been provided independently to some extent by first groups that were actually engaging in civil disobedience doing so in Santa Cruz, and then that were somewhat funded until Take Back Santa Cruz-style needle hysteria drove them out of town, or I should say to the edge of town where Emmeline Street now provides for needle disposal. I think there's one Sharps container, one big Sharps container right along Water Street after you cross the Water Street Bridge just before you reach the courthouse. But the other places have been shut down, like the Loudon Nelson Center, which not only now has a fence around its park and no restroom use unless you are one of the, you can prove you're, I don't know, not a poor person or a drug addict or a homeless person. In other words, they've closed the restrooms. They also, years ago, took out the Sharps container disposals procedures. And that, again, this is sheer prejudice. Yes, no doubt there were problems with things being stuck in the, you know, there have been toilets being clogged up on occasion and different difficulties that were a function of doing it. But the need for such facilities is so clear, particularly with the growing opioid crisis. And there was a heroin crisis back then as well. Like it was in 2009 that they stopped doing it or thereabouts. I'm not sure. There's just no excuse for this kind of succumbing to fear and paranoia. So what this new group, the Harm Reduction Coalition, is doing is it's kind of trying to get respectability by using the public health officer Arnold Leff as a backer, by trying to get some backing from the police department, the deputies. And I suppose there's nothing wrong with this, except you'll note that they say they are not going to directly provide treatment and services. This is a step back, not a step forward, though I guess if you can get county agencies to do it in a positive way, in an accessible way, that's a good thing. I don't know what the specifics are on this, and maybe I'll find out more as we proceed. Education is a good thing. A part of the City on a Hill Press story notes that Tako Frost, Western Regional Director of this Harm Reduction Coalition, noted that people used to need to find an available service provider to access programs like drug treatment, which can be challenging for houseless and undocumented individuals because of potential difficulties getting insurance or identification, which can prevent them from getting treatment, not to mention the fact that there are limited treatment programs. Now, I've got to be honest with you, I don't have the stats on the specific number of treatment programs, but I've never heard the ranting needle maniacs on such websites as Santa Cruz Mieda, or Santa Mieda, I guess it's called, which means, Santa Shit, which is a website that regularly attacks homeless advocates and homeless proposals and essentially gives the impression that homeless people are criminals, addicts, crazy folks, and bums. Although at the same time they try to say, oh, no, but that's only the bad homeless. So it's good to, counter such prejudice with educational efforts, I suppose. I don't suppose it. It's true. It's just it seems like unless you do that by also taking, at least recovering the ground that where it was lost when such groups as the Public Hysteria Task Force or the Public Safety Task Force, as the shitty council, that Santa Cruz shitty council, so designated it based on a lot of phony stats from now retired police deputy chief Steve Clark that was sort of pulled the wool over the community's eyes by suggesting that homeless people were a major crime problem when, of course, the stats for crimes were all about being in a park after dark and, of course, that great crime of sleeping at night, which is illegal everywhere in Santa Cruz, though now, thanks to Chief Andy Mills, a low priority or a no priority if you are doing it without a complaint from the constant complainers. And even then, as I mentioned in my last broadcast, the constant complainers are having trouble because Mills has found and has persuaded the council, or at least seems to be in the process of persuading the city council, shitty council, if you will, with the awareness that having police respond to fearful calls from local people who don't want to see a stranger sleeping in a vehicle in their neighborhood or get nervous when they see someone with a backpack standing on a corner with a "We'll work for food" sign is not the best use of police resources. That's not really the way to deal with real crimes in the neighborhood, although it does pander to a certain group, Take Back Santa Cruz, and its associated pseudo-respectable groups like Downtown Neighbors and Santa Cruz Neighbors and groups of that sort, Downtown Business Association, Downtown Association as they're called. Not the way to get police dealing with real crimes of assault and rape and burglary and things of that sort. Of course, it would be nice if Andy Mills actually got the police department going on dealing with the untested rape kits that he still will not clarify how many there are, how many haven't been tested, and so forth. And some PUF members are working on that, trying to encourage the Santa Cruz Police Department to come clean with what's really going on in its department around issues like that and other issues like the use of force, the actual police reports around the shooting of Sean Arlt a year and a half ago. Yeah, I know it's a while ago, but if you can get the police to be honest about things that have happened in the past, maybe you can get them to be honest about things that are going to happen and maybe even make such shootings less likely, like the murder that happened recently in Sacramento to Stephon Carter. What was it, 6 or 7 times in the back as he tried to get into his grandmother's backyard? One can go even further because up in San Francisco, as people interested in these issues probably already know, the San Francisco Department of Health, back up in February, unanimously endorsed a task force's recommendation to open what would become the first legal, safe injection site in the nation. They have such sites in Vancouver, Canada, to the north in British Columbia, but they haven't in this country, at least not legal and openly done. That's a center where people have a safe space where you can consume previously obtained drugs such as heroin and fentanyl under the supervision of staff trained to respond in the event of an overdose, and also out of sight of the children, you know, which is the excuse for putting up fences and creating laws that criminalize poor people in lots of public spaces, shutting down spaces like City Hall, expanding stay-away zones near schools, or that where the parks touch an area that's, what, 300 feet from a school? I believe it's 300 feet. Then the entire park area, so that would be the entire Poganip, becomes a triple... it's not a triple fine zone. It's a triple stay-away zone. So instead of staying away for a day, if a police officer or a ranger decides to write you a ticket for anything before it's even gone to court, you stay away for 3 days. And if it happens a second time, not instead of a week, it's 3 weeks. And instead of a month, it's 3 months. That's the excuse that youth is used to... the need for safety for youth without any evidence of a meaningful crime problem against young people by folks who are outside, or even drug addicts, for that matter. The point is that in San Francisco, in July, apparently, there's going to be an injection center opening, or at least that's what the story read in February from, I believe it was the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm really excited, according to the story, said Laura Thomas, the California State Director for the nonprofit Drug Policy Alliance. I've been working on this particular issue for over a decade. There are an estimated 22,000 intravenous drug users in San Francisco, many of whom openly inject in public areas across the city. Last year, over 100 people died in San Francisco of drug overdose, according to a report published by the Safe Injection Services Task Force. And there have been some, of course, overdose deaths here in Santa Cruz. I think even a couple at the San Lorenzo campground, according to Brent Adams and the media. So we need something like that here, obviously, and it's not happening. It's not even being discussed. They aren't even talking about bringing these stop the overdose facilities to the poor people, or I should say the I'm assuming they're poor, but that's not all. Not all of them are poor. If you're outside, you're likely to be poor. Unhoused folks who are drug addicts, because you know that would offend the gentrified right-wing constituency that's growing in Santa Cruz, as everyone else of a lower income is being driven out, or many other people are being driven out. But if you're interested in supporting the Harm Reduction Coalition, they are meeting starting at 7 o'clock tonight, Thursday, at the Capitola City Hall at 420 Capitola Avenue. Saturday is Earth Day, which I assume means San Lorenzo Park activities. I haven't seen much about it in the Sentinel. I haven't really looked at the Sentinel today, I don't think, that closely. But there is a science march, or a march for science, starting at 10 a.m. at City Hall and going to the San Lorenzo Park. They are, according to Indy Bay, people who are value science. Scientists, educators, journalists, students, neighbors, friends, and family, all races, all religions, all gender identities, all sexual orientations, all abilities, and blah, 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 blah. A wealth of opinions, perspectives, and ideas critical for the scientific process. Don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of science, and perhaps too much a fan of science. I also have some criticisms of science as well, but a march against Trump's abuses, or and Republican Party abuses, and Democratic Party abuses too, around the failure to deal with significant issues like climate change, which I'm not the most educated man on the block about, and I don't talk about much, But I mean, that's a good thing. But I'm also very wary of organizing groups that serve to essentially bolster Democratic Party candidates and elections, because I believe that they say little or nothing about the real gouger in this country, which is the war economy. They've been doing it under Obama. They did it under Clinton, and they'll probably do it again, even under Bernie Sanders, who has had little to say about significantly cutting back the military and stopping foreign wars, particularly wars involving the Middle East, where he's a strong supporter of the Israeli government. So anyway, that's a march starting at 10 o'clock at City Hall on Saturday. You can check it out and check out Earth Day. Of course, tomorrow, I perhaps goes without saying for regular listeners or even irregular listeners or even people who don't listen at all, it's 420, which is, of course, this will be the, it's not going to be the first 420 after the passage of Proposition 64, which passed in 2016. So, boy, I must have covered this last year, but I don't remember the details of how things went. But up on campus, usually a big to-do, and there's also a lot of repressive apparatus that's used to stop people from coming onto campus and make people who are on campus feel nervous. I don't know if there's going to be less of that this year. I don't see any real meaningful cutback in the repressive mentality of, for example, the city of Santa Cruz. I don't know much about the UCSC authorities. The city of Santa Cruz still refuses to allow a cafe where you can walk in and either vape or smoke or even just have some marijuana edibles, as, for example, is the case in San Francisco. Again, San Francisco is far in advance of Santa Cruz on this issue. So I can't really say. And, of course, the city and the county are both trying to severely restrict marijuana cultivation, distribution, and sales. Again, in ways that they aren't trying to do that with much more toxic pharmaceuticals and other recreational drugs like alcohol and tobacco. I mean, that's the obvious. It's said so many times. But it's still there. It's a glaring reality. It's in plain sight. And it's nonetheless ignored by the authorities and by those of us who might force the authorities to stop ignoring it. Also on Saturday, for those who are fans, the NAACP, National Association of Advancement of Colored People, if you want to pay $65, you can go to their Freedom Fund Gala at the Dream Inn from 5 to 8. And their guest speaker, appropriately enough, is a guy called Amos C. Brown. And he, and this is the Reverend Dr. Amos C. Brown. I believe this is a former supervisor in San Francisco as well, who in 99 proposed more criminalization measures for the homeless up there. He persuaded the city to close public plazas to homeless campers and public drunks. And he also proposed to crack down on panhandling on median strips, which Santa Cruz has done, although people continue to get ticketed and harassed by police for standing on a median with a sign so that charitable people passing by can pass them something, as many do. And anyway, so this guy, Brown, is going to be, appropriately enough, leading the pack of the NAACP. And I say that because I am not impressed with groups that claim to be concerned with civil rights for groups that are abused by the police. And unhoused and homeless people are only one of them. African Americans are a big one. So are Latino Americans, or I should say Hispanic Americans, Mexican Americans, Guatemalan Americans, and folks from down south generally. Undocumented people. We need people who are really going to stand up when these abuses are happening locally and not just, you know, throw stones at Trump, who's essentially intensifying what Obama was doing all along, just like with the wars. I have to keep repeating this because, I don't know, probably those of you who are listening know it enough anyway. And so I won't say it again, at least not for the next few minutes. Let me roll out another song, and then we'll roll into, I guess it was a week ago at the Food Not Bombs shindig, maybe even 2 weeks ago. But let's hear some music first.
In short, he tweeted, and it's being seen as a reflection of the company he's been keeping lately. More now on a president on the attack from CNN's Pamela Brown, who joins us from the White House tonight. So, do we know why the president is in attack mode?
Hey, Anderson, Pam took the night off, sweetie. I'll take it from here.
You can't stop the arrogance of a racist off his pills. You can try to stop the sneaky right propaganda that he shills. And you can try to be a president with no competence or skills. But the worst is surely yet to come, cause he just can't stop his tiny thumb. And he's lost what was left of his mind, now he's full on cray-cray. And you can't stop his tweets since before he tried politics, way back when Twitter first was founded in 2006. We've all been blocking cyber trolls and keeping lunatics at bay. But you can't block the damage to democracy he's likely to do. We can wonder why his hair looks like a pile of poo. But when the cyber troll and lunatic is running the USA,
sir, the administration says you resigned as Veterans Affairs Secretary, but you have another story. What is the truth?
Well, the Vacancy Act is a very
cut the crap. Did he fire you on Twitter?
Yes.
You can't stop the rhetoric that rushes through his lips. You can try to stop his stupid face as it stares at an eclipse. But if you call him on his bullshit, he'll fire back from his fingertips. Don't you just the vice president, you'll get on your knees and pray, yes. Cause you can't stop his tweets, and he couldn't be seedier, because he fires his whole staff on social media, and he's less educated than his Wikipedia might say, hey. So he can't comprehend that there's no border wall, cause no one will build it, or just admit the deal on DACA's dead cause he killed it. See, he's kinda lost his marbles, which is why I'm not thrilled to say that he can't stop his tweets.
President Trump is applying a tremendous amount of pressure, just like he did with little rocket man Kim Jong-un. Now it's about time an American president stood up for our country's sovereignty.
You can't stop his sycophants because their heads are up his ass. And you just can't trust a flim-flam man as he scams the working class. And you can ask him to be rational, but my guess is he'll probably pass. Because he bashes Amazon with glee.
That when he gets attacked, he's going to hit back. I think the American people elected somebody who's tough, who's smart, and who's a fighter. And that's Donald Trump.
Oh, you can't justify why all his tweets are always packed with 280 characters and not one single fact.
Fake news.
But the Russia probe is looming now and he's trying to distract. Because his girlfriends are all talking smack at the special counsel's on his back. It's no wonder his self-doubt and insecurities on display. And you can try to coax him from contributing to plummeting stocks and blowing dull results that rile up his bitches and thoughts. You can wonder, you can ponder how a president talks this way. But you can't stop his tweets, cause his blood pressure is starting to climb, and now he's freaking out because he knows it's
Mueller time.
And if they finally find him guilty of committing a crime, he'll pay. But you can't stop his tweets.
Trump on a Twitter tirade.
One more tweet from the president.
Trump is in a Twitter storm.
And disagree with him, agree with him to cut out the crap, because he's gonna kill us all with just one iPhone app. But unless you're his own daughter, you can't sit in his lap and say that he should drop bragging.
CNN and Stormy Tate. Oh, not her.
If you can walk and follow, mute him and dispute him, but there's no way.
That's Randy Rainbow, a parody, You Can't Stop the Tweets. It's, again, as I always say, better on YouTube if you can watch it, but maybe this will encourage you to take a look. And I'll give my usual disclaimer. Randy's signing on to the Russiagate hysteria is nonsense, but a lot of the rest of it I really like, and I hope you enjoyed it. Let's jump back to Food Not Bombs on one of their last Sundays. And here's a couple of interviews that I found, in a way, kind of heartwarming. Mainly because, for those of you who know me, not just my voice on the radio, I have a car, often, which I, as quickly as I can, cover with bumper stickers, carefully selected bumper stickers. And the cars I get are pretty much clunkers, so they tend to last only a few years. I get them cheaply, and I kind of go through them, and then they're gone. This car, the last car I had a lot of really nice bumper stickers on it. Not nice in the sense of, clean and cute and dandy, but to the point. And I hated to see my past cars go, but that's usually what would happen. But this time, the car got passed on to Food Not Bombs. And this, in a way, is the saga of what happened to folks who were driving in the car. Maybe it's an object lesson, but, here it is.
So I'm here at Food Not Bombs about 20 to 5 on April 15th. I'm talking with a man who survived an ordeal involving a bumper sticker covered car. What is your name, sir, if you wish to say?
Anthony.
And Anthony, what's this about a car and bumper stickers?
So we were driving a vehicle that's covered in political bumper stickers. We were in Taos, New Mexico on a back street on a Sunday. New Mexico State Police passed us, and then whipped around, came up behind us, and pulled us over in a very secluded area.
What time of day?
This is broad day. It's at noon. It was just after noon. So he came up to the vehicle already aggravated. He was red in the face.
What was he upset about?
Don't know. So after the incident, we were recording from two different angles. As soon as we got pulled over, we started rolling cameras.
Video camera.
Yep.
You're doing a documentary, I understand.
Correct.
And what issue?
Well, Food is a Right is the name of the documentary we're working on right now, which is Food Not Bombs, Food Not Bombs documentary. But the next documentary that we're working on, which involves our incident, is called Your Rights Are Not a Privilege. Mm-hmm. So he came up to the vehicle. He was already aggravated. He's asking us to, he'd never identified himself. He just said, roll down your window. We said, no, thank you. He said, step out of the car and I'll tell you why I pulled you over. We said, no, thank you. So he goes and he calls back up. We call 911 because we know the state police shoot people there. And we're in a secluded area. Nobody's driving those roads on a Sunday. So we called 911. The Taos police showed up the same time his backup showed up. So he had three other state police officers who ran up to the car screaming and yelling. The sergeant ran up to the window, even though I'd rolled down the window a little bit so I could start passing him my identification and the information on the vehicle. They grabbed the window. They never asked for it. They just grabbed the window, started telling me to get the fuck out of the car.
Did you say get the fuck out of there? They used the F word.
Yeah, the one state police, he never talked to anybody. Nobody was talking over the radio, so there's no communication. So as far as I understand, he didn't know what the hell is going on. He just comes running out of a state police vehicle with his baton in his hand with a glass breaker end, threatening, shaking his hand, screaming, I'm going to break your goddamn window.
Do we know the name of this erstwhile officer?
That one was, no, I don't remember his name. And it was Sergeant Lucero, and then State Police Officer Cabanas is the one who pulled us over. but Lucero is the sergeant who broke the window. So after they're screaming and yelling, they pull the window out and then grab my arm and try and pull me through the window, through the door, while I'm still seatbelted. This, supposedly they pulled us over because I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. But if they hadn't destroyed the evidence yet, their footage, which they kept claiming over and over that they have, me on camera not wearing my seatbelt, their camera should show I'm wearing my seatbelt. So it was a wrongful arrest. They arrested me for failure to identify, resisting arrest, and dialing 911 without
a call. Did they ask you to identify yourselves initially?
He did ask for my identification at one point, but he never gave me a chance to give it to him before he left to go back to his car to call backup. So,
but you did indicate you wouldn't give it to him.
Correct. And we did identify ourselves to 911 when we called 911.
And did you also, at any point did they say you're under arrest?
After they had me out of the vehicle on the ground and they're screaming, they have me on the ground and three officers on me while another one's screaming, get the fuck on the ground. That's when they told me, that's when they told me I was under arrest.
Well, time enough. Go ahead.
Yeah, close enough. So they take me, they drag me across the concrete, they put me into the vehicle. When we're in the vehicle and they're taking me to the police station before they took me to the hospital, I asked him, I was like, what set you guys off? Was it the car? And he didn't say anything. And this is another officer, not the one that pulled us over.
He was one of the officers who showed up.
Yeah, he was one of the officers.
He was upset.
He was upset too. Although they were all, you know, fist bumping each other after they dragged me and my wife out of the car, we weren't resisting at all. I said, well, what set you guys off? Was it the car? He didn't say anything. I go, not even our vehicle. We were just delivering at the Taos. And he looked back in surprise and said, that's not your car? I said, nope, we're just delivering it for nonprofit. And he says, oh, and said nothing to me for the rest of the time until he came into the room and asked me if I wanted to go to the hospital because I was clearly bleeding. So they took me to the hospital and then took me straight to jail, where I spent 4 days without a phone call and 3 days without even knowing why I was under arrest.
Did you request a phone call?
I requested a phone call, requested to speak to counsel, even when I was still in the state police custody, when I was leaving the hospital, I was like, well, I need counsel. And he says, yeah, that's your right. And just puts me back in the car and doesn't say anything to me the rest of the time. When I get in there, when I get into the Taos County Jail, I tell them I need to call counsel. And they just kept saying, yeah, well, we'll get to that. And then, of course, never do. And
do they have a phone, as they do in the Santa Cruz County Jail, for making calls out?
They have, yeah. So they have one right there where you're being booked or where you're being checked in, I guess. So they have a phone right there.
Reservations are being made for you.
Correct. And and it only costs you $10. They only charge you $10 to go to jail.
So that's pretty cheap considering. Now, what kind of cuisine did you have there?
It's very sparse. It was like peanut butter and jelly and bread. When I told them I stay away from breads and dyes and sugars. And Angela actually has a very strict diet because she has asthma that's triggered by food. So she has food allergies that'll cause her to go into a serious asthma attack and she'll be hospitalized. They just told her, just don't eat it. So she lost 4 pounds in jail over 4 days.
She should be very grateful. This could be the new dietary miracle.
Right? She clearly lost a lot of weight in there. So.
Well, you should be happy.
Yeah. So. All in all, it felt like it was an experience that they were showing us things they shouldn't have been showing us. Like all the drugs that were in the jail. And all the people, when they put me into general population, half of those people were high 24/7.
What drugs?
Well, some of it was crystal meth and some of it I don't know. They just said some of it was crystal meth. But they were putting it in their eyes. They were reducing it to a powder and putting it in their eyes, and sometimes they were just snorting it.
And what impact did this have on their relationship with you?
They actually, all the inmates are super cool. They gave me socks because I didn't have socks. They won't let you wear socks in jail unless you were wearing white socks when you came in. But I had merino wool socks on.
Next time.
Next time, yeah. I don't want there to be next time, but next
probably
time.
Not.
But yeah, so we were, we both were in there for 3 days without even knowing why we were being held. And then we should have seen the magistrate within 24 hours of being incarcerated, and we didn't see him until our fourth day.
What was that like?
It was dehumanizing. Completely honest, it was dehumanizing.
Seeing the magistrate or being in the jail or both?
All of it, because even when you're... We were supposedly... If we're being pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt, why do we need to be handcuffed handcuffed our wrists together that are then strapped to our waist, that are then strapped to our ankles?
Outside?
Yeah. Is the jewelry
you
was
might escape for one thing.
Right, I know, because
officer safety.
Okay. So to even move from one secure room into another secure room, they chain you up, and then they bring you into a magistrate like that who lectured us about how we were not being compassionate to the officers who unlawfully arrested us.
Name of the judge?
Ortega. And he's the
The chili?
Yeah. So.
Do you see any other interesting activity in the courtroom while you were there?
No, just clearly the judge is on the state police side, which, you know, in a sense he should be, but these guys are all related. So all the Spaniards, all the state police Spaniards, and the judge, of course, is a Spaniard as well. So in Taos, it's kind of like that. So.
Well, now he's supposed to be nonpartisan, you know.
Yeah.
And you're making a rather serious accusation here, Anthony.
No, I'm making a pretty common knowledge statement.
So were you able to have communication with anybody outside the jail during this period?
Well, on the third day, how I found out is a friend of ours realized we were missing a meeting. We missed two meetings with him, and both of those were about rights and about state police abusing abusing their power.
A chance to actually do it in action.
Exactly. So he found out we were missing, and then he found out that we were in jail, and he came to jail, and he had to go through a lot of process. After several hours, he was able to get in to visit me and to let me know that what I was being charged with.
This was an attorney or a friend?
This is a friend. So, and we were appointed an attorney after a month. We were finally appointed an attorney the day before we were supposed to see the judge.
And it was a public defender?
It was a public defender.
What kind of service did he provide?
Jack shit. He said nothing to the judge. And as a matter of fact, Angela's attorney walked out of the room just before she was called up and walked back into the room after she was called.
Maybe
after
they had to go to the bathroom.
Maybe.
It's a pisser, man, I gotta say. And what were you sentenced to?
Nothing. They dismissed the charges without prejudice. We were lectured about how that it was so compassionate that the state police did not come to prosecute us, but he was going to leave it dismissed without prejudice so they could charge us again at any time within 2 years.
And so are you now seeking an attorney who will hopefully get a fat commission or a thin commission for the lawsuit?
Yes, yeah, because we were unlawfully arrested and detained, and the whole process from the time that we were pulled over to the time that we were released, we were dehumanized and our rights were completely violated.
Are any Taos attorneys likely to take this case?
One. And he actually defended a lady, and his office actually got them a settlement against state police. She was pulled over. The state police were very hostile with her children in the van. She advised them, after she had already been given her ticket, that she was leaving, and he was still hostile and aggressive with her. So she very slowly pulls away from him. He steps back, pulls out his weapon, and unloads his weapon completely into their van with her children in the car. So this, we know about this story. This is why we called 911 when we got pulled over by state police.
What happened to that woman?
She got a fat settlement out of it. I believe she moved out of town. The state officer was given immunity by the state for his crime, but he was also allowed to resign from the state police so the Taos County could hire him as an officer.
Oh, yeah, that experience.
Right, yeah, and he probably got a raise.
Name of the woman who did this, if you wish to say it.
Sorry?
The name of the victim?
I don't recall her name, but I know Catherine Hardy represented her, and that is also going to be the same person that's going to represent us.
Your next court date is?
We have no court date as of yet, but we've finished our part as far as, like, their criminal case against us.
What happened to your video?
We have both video intact. So we've got to
destroy your video?
No, which is amazing. These guys not only were teddy bears, even though they dragged me across the concrete, they didn't shoot us. They didn't shoot at us, but of course we had witnesses.
Maybe toughening up. You know, this. You might complain about this.
I know. Well, we were told by attorneys that if we do file a suit against them, we need to hide.
Really?
They will come after us.
Well, that should make you feel at least you're never alone.
Right. It's good to know that we have eyes on us and people that are concerned about our safety.
What did Angela think of the whole thing?
She thought it was great.
Shall I ask her?
Oh, yeah, she had a great time. She had a great time.
Anything?
She was singing and dancing in jail. She was having even when they were arresting her, she's singing. She went completely limp when they yanked her out of the car. She got the exact same charges as I did. Even though they never asked her for her ID, they never, but they had absolutely no reason to even give her a ticket or
something. Guilty by association.
Right. That's got to be it.
I mean, it's pretty clear. Certainly she was in the car with you. You won't deny that, I hope.
No, she was in the car with
you. There you go. You see? So. I think if you come to a co-understanding, you'll eventually... Did you ever go to confession on this issue?
I did not, no.
That could be one of the problems.
Yeah, I mean, the good Lord needs to hear it.
You got to remember, the spiritual authorities and the temporal authorities both need to be satisfied.
Absolutely.
You got to walk out, your soul is a matter of issue here.
Yes, yes, and I should be thankful for the state police trying to protect the fuck out of me.
Yes, very well put, yes. So your work doing this video, is it nearly finished? When will we be able to see the finished product?
The first part of this product will be done on May 22nd. So hopefully we will have it finished and in Keith's hands so he can display it with the 38th anniversary. But we're also turning the Food is a Right series, or documentary, into a series. We want to travel around the United States and around the world, showcasing Food Not Bombs and their work for social change.
How long will the video be?
The first one's going to be 45 minutes, and then from there, I believe we're going to do 25 minutes each segment.
Out of how many hours of video?
Oh, right now we're probably up to 30-something hours, and it's probably going to be about 80 hours once we're done.
And we've been talking to that video journalist on the lam,
Anthony Page.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
With a woman who's washing a dish. Actually, it's a pan here at the Food Not Bombs meal. How are you doing this kind of menial labor, or womenial labor, or something? What do you think? What is this all about?
Well, I don't think it's about genders, and I think dishes have to get washed.
There you have it. A no-nonsense answer. And I understand, we just had an interview with Anthony, your colleague, and he had one particular account defaming the well-beloved Taoist authorities and the state authorities there. Do you want to give us an account of what actually happened? Maybe clear up the record so that your fans and the police department can understand more fully what the situation is.
Well, we had out-of-state license plates and a car that's covered with political bumper stickers.
How could you do that? I mean, that could be a direct antagonism to the people involved.
They're working. According to most other law enforcement, they are not allowed to bring their emotions into it. They are being paid, and they have to stay calm.
Are you suggesting these officers got emotional?
I am suggesting they got emotional.
Well, describe what happened.
So we're driving down a street. He sees the out-of-state plates. Pulling people over for no seatbelt is just kind of an easy thing to do. It happens all over in California.
Were you wearing your seatbelt?
Yes, and so was Anthony, or Philip Page.
You weren't lying for the civil lawsuit or anything like that?
Nope. They've got the video to prove it. Or should I say they destroyed the video that proves it.
Now, did you see them light the video on fire? No, you didn't, did you?
No, but they denied us getting them.
Well, maybe they felt it would be a little too traumatic, or it was a difficult experience for you.
I strongly doubt that.
Well, so then they pulled you over for your seatbelt crime, and then what happened?
Well, then things got heated. We told them that they were violating their own policies, and they busted our window and took us to jail.
No more details that sprung to mind?
Tried to break Anthony's arm, yelling, cussing, threatening to break the window, not calming the situation down. We were both being very calm.
And how were you treated personally?
Like a criminal.
And specifically, were you roughed up?
I was dragged.
And is that because you refused to walk, resisting arrest? Is that right?
I did refuse to walk. I went limp and let them carry me, which they couldn't do, and I weigh all of 116 pounds.
Well, the job can sometimes get these folks down. You don't seem to appreciate that.
No, I don't.
So anyway, you went to the jail.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Well, we didn't know why we were arrested. We didn't know, I wasn't allowed to make a phone call. And technically, so according to their code, they're supposed to give you 3 opportunities to make a phone call 25 minutes from arriving at the facility. 2 days later, they finally gave me a phone call.
Was it worth the phone in your cell?
No, like when we got moved, that's whenever I got the phone call because the phone was in the cell. But we were held in a kind of a other, I don't know what you'd call it, a holding cell, and there was no phone in there.
But surely you had some rather tasty meals.
No. In fact, I have dietary restrictions. They asked me 3 times what they were. I said no sugar, no dairy, no bread, and they gave me the meals that were pretty much just sugar, dairy, and bread, and meat.
And you said no soap.
No soap. No, I got soap.
You got soap. That's good. Now, what about the other inmates? How did they strike you? Or did they strike you?
They did not strike me. They gave me the clothes off their back. One woman had socks. She gave me socks. One woman had a long sleeve thermal. She gave me that literally off of her back. She went and changed, gave it to me.
Do you maintain any kind of connection with the folks who were in jail? Have you maintained correspondence with any of them?
No comment.
Very interesting. And I understand you then went back to court. Well, how did the judge, Judge Ortega is the judge who actually oversaw your case. Tell me about the swift justice that he administered.
Oh, goodness. Very biased. Almost like he had been talking to them. He was convinced that we were not wearing a seatbelt, which a judge is supposed to be non-biased on things like that. Apparently didn't see the evidence, yet is saying that the officers were very courteous to us and that we needed to have been very courteous back to them.
To which you replied?
I didn't say anything.
And Professor Public Defender immediately stood up and objected.
No, he left the room.
Well, maybe he was embarrassed.
You know what? He might have been, and he should be.
Then what happened?
It was dismissed without prejudice.
I understand you're on the lam from these cops because they may have a civil lawsuit out, and things don't go well for individuals who sue the law enforcement authorities of New Mexico.
In New Mexico, I don't know if things go over well for people who do things like that. But I don't know.
Are you apprehensive about going back to New Mexico?
No.
Have you been back since?
No. Well, I mean, we stayed there after it happened.
And no one pursued you?
No.
Perhaps such stories are exaggerated.
Could be.
Any thoughts about anything that happened that you want to mention?
It's not okay. That's all I got.
And we've been talking with?
Angela.
Thank you, Angela.
Thank you.
Razor.
And Razor, you're here with a sign that says Syria.
Because pink pussy hats won't stop the wars.
It's written on your sign.
With the accent on S for plural wars, like we're involved in every conflict on the planet.
Is this a critique of the pro-Clinton rallies?
Let me just put it this way. It's a Democrat town, and are all the Bernie...
We may have more tape from, I guess it was April 15th, but that's pretty much the gist of what happened to Anthony and Angela, according to their account. Their vehicle, which it was once my vehicle, has been seen around town. So you may get a second opportunity to take a quick peek at the older sticker mobile as it passes by. Still in town, of course.
Imagine a job interview to pick the button steward, the button that would blow us up and make the world a sewer. Well, here's the guy who got the job, and what has he to say about the nuclear weapon stock with which he wants to play?
Putin has built up their military again and again and again. Their military is much stronger. Our nuclear is old and tired, and his nuclear is tippy-top from what I hear.
What did he just say?
Tippy-top from what I hear. I love tippy-tops. I love tippy-tops. Tippy-top, tippy-top, tippy-top. I love tippy-tops. I love tippy-tops. Tippy-top, tippy-top, tippy-top.
There's a fool in the house with the girls he's handy, but with the nation one must doubt his modus operandi. This song won't make sense till you know about the NPR, the Nuclear Posture Review, and it's beyond bizarre. According to this new review, our nukes are just not credible. It's hard to fit this in a rhyme, so I'm just going to explain it.
So right out of the Trump Defense Department, we have the Nuclear Posture Review of 2018, which says in a nutshell that our nuclear weapons are too big and too deadly to ever use, and the whole world knows that we would never use them, and so we've lost our nuclear credibility. To regain our nuclear credibility, they propose that we manufacture a stockpile of low-yield nuclear weapons, which they say we will never need to use, because our adversaries will think that we will use them, which means we won't need to use them, since it's only when they think we wouldn't use them that we would end up having to use them. But in order for us to make them think we would use them, we have to threaten to use them. So we say that we would use them, and maybe we even use them here and there, because after all, they are only low-yield nuclear weapons, so everyone will be afraid that we'll use them even more. And then we can finally feel safe and secure. And that's the gist of the Nuclear Posture Review of 2018 from the Trump White House. Low-yield suggests a kinder, gentler sort of nuke until you realize that the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were technically low-yield weapons. We already have around 1,000 of those in our stockpile.
I love tippy-tops. They did this to us once before we had to duck and cover. If we fall for it once again,
okay, well, I'm on the line with Anthony Prince, who's a lawyer, organizer, and civil rights activist. I guess you're out of Palo Alto. Is that accurate?
No, that's not accurate.
Sorry.
My principal place of business, as we say, is in the East Bay, sandwiched right on the border between South Berkeley and North Oakland. But I travel pretty extensively throughout the state, and most recently as part of the California Poor People's Campaign. So I'm all over the place.
I got you. Well, I, of course, first ran into you down in Salinas when you had effectively, along with the activists in Salinas and the houseless folks down there, held off several nasty Salinas city ordinances criminalizing homeless people. And I understand that that's, you know, right now it's not looking too good down there. But the issue, I guess, that I wanted to start with was a sort of a, because people have been following this, perhaps, on this station, because I've been issuing regular reports. What in the last year or two has been happening in Salinas that you're aware of, and where is it going now? And we'll start with that. I know that you're really concerned now with the statewide, nationwide, who knows, maybe even worldwide, attempt to rekindle Martin Luther King's legacy with this poverty campaign. But let's begin a bit with Salinas. Remind listeners what you did, attempted to do, and others attempted to do, how that ended up and where we are now.
Okay, well, I guess we can begin about 3 years ago. As some of your listeners may recall, it was about 3 years ago that the city of Salinas put into play a proposed ordinance that would effectively criminalize homeless people even beyond their already existing criminalized status by seizing property that belonged to homeless people, prohibiting them from placing personal personal items on public streets and sidewalks and parks, and prohibiting camping of any kind. And it was essentially an ordinance targeting the homeless encampment in Chinatown, the old section of Salinas, where the city and the police department have for years been corralling homeless people and essentially creating that homeless encampment. Now they determined they were going to destroy it because some developers wanted to come in and revitalize that area. So we tried to get the city council to reconsider whether wanted to enact this facially unconstitutional ordinance. They would not reconsider. They went ahead and passed it, so we proceeded into federal court attempting to obtain an injunction to stop enforcement of the ordinance. And we made, alongside of that, various claims, constitutional claims, everything from the Fourth Amendment search and seizure, Fifth Amendment due process, 14th Amendment, substantive due process, and the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. And we did get the city to back down, and for 6 months we stopped them from enforcing that ordinance. And really not just stopped them from enforcing the ordinance, but we got them to stop the sweeps. They have been conducting sweeps, seizing and destroying valuable personal property, medications, clothing, photographs belonging to homeless people. They've been doing that for years. So we made a little history by, for the first time, actually forcing the city of Salinas to suspend those awful sweeps.
And this was over the winter 2015-2016.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember the exact dates now, but yes, it was roughly around that time period. So ultimately, what the city did is that they did repeal the problematic ordinance and replaced it with an ordinance that had a little bit more due process, or at least facially improved due process protections. But we still felt that it was deficient and that it still left the status of homeless people that of criminals. In other words, basically saying you can't, things you do by necessity, sleeping and putting your items down and when you have no place to go. What we did do, though, is that we did force them to permit camping. The new ordinance allowed overnight camping and essentially preserved some of these encampments, and it kind of restrained the city from breaking up these encampments for the most part. Since then, however, the city has gotten, let me just say what happened was, even though we got some of these measures and some of the worst features of the law repealed, they still went ahead and destroyed the camp. They used a public health and safety exception as a justification to destroy this homeless encampment and effectively dispersed some 300 men, women, and children into the streets of Salinas. We actually, it was March 16th, I believe that was the date that we actually stopped them physically from breaking up the camp when we couldn't get the court to stop them. We physically stopped them by essentially creating a human chain and barricading the streets with our bodies on that day. But that was short-lived, and the very next day they came back with police, with contractors, with city officials. They roped off the entire area and systematically took the camp down.
But then for 6 months after that, there was a Wes White and other activists led a nightly encampment on the very grounds of City Hall itself, right?
That's correct. Under leadership of Wes White, who is now the president of Salinas Homeless Union, they reformed the camp as not just a camp of necessity, but a camp of political protest right there in front of City Hall. They occupied that space for 6 months. And it was a self-regulated, self-policed, clean, neat, orderly, crime-free, drug-free encampment of homeless people. Religious figures came down. People brought food. There were prayers. There was a real community. They tried to restore the sense of community that they had in Chinatown. And that increasingly angered the city. And finally, 6 months after what they call the flagpole community, because it was right there at the flagpole in front of the city hall, they went in and enacted an emergency measure, again, unconstitutional, and in my view, in violation of the existing code. more or less took away the limited protection of camping that had been provided in the prior ordinance, broke up that camp, and to this day now they have on the books, still in existence, an unconstitutional ordinance restricts not only camping but free speech, because that protest was not just, that protest was protected. It was a camp of necessity and a camp of political protest.
It's not, you know, it's interesting, so, Anthony, because during this period of time when the flagpole community survived and thrived, actually, the peculiar law was that you couldn't set up a tent during the day, but you could during the night. Is that correct?
That's correct. And our position on that was that what that did is effectively turned the homeless community back to the status of being nomads, of being pack animals, if I could, because they were saying, well, you can't camp between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m., but when the 6 a.m. and the police were rousting people out of these tents and out of these meager shelters that they had constructed, and you're back on the streets, and you can't have all your possessions. You can only have what you can physically carry, because we're still going to prohibit you from setting anything down or having a cart to move things around with. So that was our problem with the, and it continues to be our problem with the existing ordinances. Now, my understanding most recently, Robert, is that the we did bring some other legal forces into play, and they threatened to bring a new lawsuit against the city. And in response to that threat, it is my understanding that the city has curtailed writing tickets and making charges and writing homeless people up for infractions or violations of the ordinance.
And
so they're taking it for the moment, kind of a suspension, not a formal suspension, but seems that they're not enforcing these measures.
Does that mean homeless people's property is not being seized?
Well, actually, it is in some cases and not in others. There's a random. The reports we're getting is that there are still violations. There is still property being seized, and it's supposed to be stored. But of course, that's very problematic. The city is on its face, not enforcing these things. They're not pursuing the matters in court, as far as we know. But that has not stopped the harassment. My understanding from what Wes White and other members of the homeless union have told me, and I'm legal counsel for the homeless union, is that they're still being harassed, they're still being chased, they're still being rousted out of various encampments, and property being seized, and more or less it's at the whim of police, and in some cases, in other cases, police are sympathetic. The police are sympathetic, and they're giving some of our community members some notice, and they move to one place or another, but it's not a policy that's is consistent, and regardless of any current situation, the bottom line is that the city is failing to provide housing to people who need it. The city continues to spend money on agribusiness. The city continues to spend money on projects that are about attracting high-tech ag and other sectors of the business community, and is disregarding the needs of people, and not just homeless people, but poor people, renters, farm workers, retired people, kids. 10% of all the students in the Salinas school district, some 2,000 children are homeless. That's the sad state of affairs that is going unaddressed. So our view is that we're continuing to organize, continuing to build the union, signing members up into the homeless union. And we're very happy to see that people like Wes White and Rita Acosta and Diana Blaylock and the people that have been involved in the various lawsuits are the recognized leadership in that of the homeless community.
And indeed, as in Santa Cruz, it is still illegal to in Santa Cruz, it's illegal to have to stand with a picket sign on City Hall grounds an hour after they've closed the buildings, on the lawn.
If that's the case, Robert, that's facially unconstitutional.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And, you know, California has hundreds, I think in the neighborhood of 500 to 600 of these ordinances. No state in the country has more laws criminalizing poor people and homeless people than the state of California. And no state in the United States has more encampments, more homeless encampments. They're not going to be able to stop the formation of these camps. They break up the camp, the camps reform. You know, they tear one down, another comes up because people are poor. More and more people are joining the ranks of the community that can't afford, you know, adequate housing. They're sleeping in their cars, their RVs, on the streets, under the viaducts, by the tracks. And at some point, it's going to have to be faced as a humanitarian crisis, as a matter of, are we going to let people continue to live and die on the streets, or are we going to take the measures necessary and required under the law to stop this slaughter? Because it is a slaughter.
Well, maybe they'll call in the Saudi Arabian Air Force to do some bombing. Who knows? Facetiousness aside, in your neck of the woods in the East Bay, particularly in Oakland and in San Francisco, under freeways, lots of homeless encampments have been showing up. Is that happening in Salinas as well, as far as you know?
Yeah, I mean, the camp, by breaking up Chinatown, they dispersed these camps. In some cases, there's one family by itself, an individual. In some cases, they're grouping together in larger numbers in Chinatown itself. You have the tents have reappeared, that was inevitable, given that there are still a few services available down there. So people are going to go where they can get a meal, where they could get their clothes cleaned, you know, by some of the providers. So yeah, they're popping up and they're proliferating, and in some cases they're along the tracks, and Caltrans has been routinely breaking them up and seizing property. In some cases they're within the city, some cases they're in other parts of Monterey County where the sheriffs are going after them. So we're only seeing an intensification of this war on the homeless, and it's part of a broader war against poor people. And that's why we're part of this Poor People's Campaign.
Now, you've also been
in a war on poverty to a war against the poor.
Right on. You've also recently extended yourself to help out the Marysville homeless. That Raylan and Brian up there have been seeking your help in a lawsuit they've been pushing. Which you want to give us an update on that, if there is any update?
Yeah, of course. I don't know how many of your listeners are aware, but in October of 2016, the city of Marysville and Yuba County collaborated in destroying a decades-long standing homeless encampment on the river there in Marysville. And of course, in the same way that they did in Salinas, where the police and the city actually created these camps by forcing people into these areas, once they had a new plan, and once they realized they wanted to put some investment into these areas or otherwise develop them, then it was time for these same people they corralled into these areas to be kicked out. So they kicked out hundreds of people and destroyed thousands of articles of personal property. And so Brian Lee Brown and Raylan Butcher — Raylan had been known as the mayor of Hollywood Park, the name of the camp was Hollywood Park Camp, and she was known as the mayor, and Brian and Raylan were the leaders and still are the leaders of that homeless community. And so Brian filed a lawsuit on his own without legal counsel, handwritten complaints that he filed with the city, and was prosecuting his own lawsuit. And it appeared that the lawsuit was about to be tossed when I was contacted by Wes White from the Salinas Homeless Union, who encouraged me to go up there and find out what was happening. And I found out what was happening, and I agreed to come in as counsel of record for Brian. His case is going forward. We survived what essentially was a motion to dismiss. Excuse me. That was filed. We survived a motion to dismiss that was filed by the city, what they call a demur, and now the case is on for trial. There's not a trial date yet, but there will be a trial date set in July.
And you're the counsel.
We're also looking at filing a civil rights claim in a federal court on behalf of all the people that were broken out of, that were exiled from that camp and all their possessions destroyed. And we've enlisted the help of some other attorneys in that. We should be filing that relatively soon.
Sounds good. I know up in Oakland, a number of attorneys, Osha Newman and others, have been pressing for a lawsuit to recover and stop the seizure of homeless property by Caltrans and other authorities up there. Do you know what's going on with that?
You know, I'm aware of what Osha and the other attorneys are doing. I haven't really been following those cases. I mean to start getting a little bit more on them and becoming aware of them as we move to take steps to unify what's been a scattered resistance across the state of California. I don't want to share too much at this point, but we are in the process of taking steps to weld together these individual efforts, smaller groupings, some of which have been around for years, others recently forming. A lot of these homeless encampments have their own government, essentially, produce their own leaders. We're aiming to unify them so that they have their own voice, and we can end the state of affairs where someone speaks for them, some so-called homeless service provider or some charitable organization or some other self-appointed spokesperson who may or may not have the genuine interest of poor people at heart.
Some attorney, perhaps?
Give them their own voice, their own organization.
And that would include an attorney. An attorney.
I'm sorry?
That would include an attorney, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very privileged to be the union attorney, for the Marysville Union. They call themselves Northern California Homeless Union and the Monterey County Swings Homeless Union. And I am in touch with other attorneys in California and other states similarly situated.
Yeah, I think you missed my drift. Attorneys won't be speaking for them either. They'll be speaking for themselves, right?
Well, you know, what we have, Robert, and we've forged this relationship over the years, is we have a collaborative approach. The way we approach it is that all of us bring to this struggle our individual skills, training, and experience, and we work in a collaborative fashion. The lawsuit that we prosecuted in against the city of Salinas and the lawsuit we're going forward in Yuba County, the strategy for these lawsuits is being crafted by the leadership of these unions. And that strategy is one that I carry out. I'm also helping to forge that strategy and create it. But as the attorney, and my view about the participation of attorneys in this fight is that we do not want the struggle to be subsumed or consumed or subordinated to what goes on in that courtroom. We look at the legal fight as a scaffold, if you will, as a platform and an opportunity to build organization. So no matter what happens in court, and in most cases, unfortunately, we don't get a positive result in court, but regardless of what happens with these lawsuits, we use that process to help build the unions, the homeless unions.
Talk about
the labor unions were built in the 30s and 40s.
Right. Talk about the street or, let's say, non-court aspect of this, because I guess that's what you've been working on recently with the planned Poor People's March, right?
Well, it's not a Poor People's March. We're calling it a Poor People's Campaign National Call for Moral Revival. And what that is a process that's been underway for years, and I've been part of it, the planning for years, to not just commemorate Dr. Martin Luther King and the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, but to revive and take up that baton, take up that mantle. So we have a national campaign. I'm sure your listeners are aware of Reverend William Barber in North Carolina, who created the whole Moral Mondays movement. Excuse me. And for 3 years, they systematically protested every Monday at the state capitol in Raleigh and called the attention of the state and the world to the crisis in healthcare, homelessness, poverty, racism, systemic racism, environmental degradation. So what we have now is we've launched a national campaign. We've spread to 41 states and the District of Columbia. And beginning on May 14th of this year, the day after Mother's Day, we're going to undertake 6 weeks of coordinated consecutive actions, consecutive Moral Monday actions for a period of 40 days. And that's just the launch. That's just the foundation. We're aiming to build a years-long, durable, unified, broad movement against poverty, against systemic racism, environmental degradation, and the war economy. Because you can't resolve any one of those overarching issues without resolving all of them simultaneously.
Well, I noticed one of the key issues that seems to be missing, I don't know if it was missing from what you just said, but the war in Vietnam was a major concern of King's when he, a year, at least he became really clear about it a year before he was killed. And, you know, not that, you know, we have to go back to any particular leader to be aware of what's going on now, but if you're using the, you know, the mantle of Martin Luther King, and maybe you are to some extent because it's, you know, the anniversary of his assassination, 50th anniversary, what about the foreign wars? I mean...
Well, no, you missed what I said.
Sorry, go ahead.
A very essential pillar. We have what we call four pillars, actually five, but we're talking about the war economy, very much so. We are very much against, I mean, the United States just launched a completely illegal, unjustified, and undeclared war action in Syria, dropping these bombs at the cost of millions of dollars and I don't know how many lives, and at the expense of programs in the United States that are being slashed to the bone in order to finance this new regenerated military industrial war making machine. So that is very much a part of what we're doing, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I understand that, and of course that's been the case for years. But for example, one of the weaknesses of the Bernie Sanders campaign, for me, weaknesses, one of the indications that it was simply, to me, a Judas goat campaign to lead people into the Clinton camp, was that there was no significant attack on Obama's war policies.
Uh-huh.
Is that a part? I mean, is this campaign going to be an attack? I mean, certainly an attack on the war machine, but what about the specific intervention in what is it, 7, 8, I don't know how many foreign countries that are currently under bombing or proxy bombing by the U.S.?
We are opposed to the domination of the culture, the economy, and the entire orientation, the budget process, and the world domination of the United States through this military machine. That is the position of this campaign. This campaign has a significant part of our leadership, our veterans who have come back, some of the leading organizations that have Iraq Veterans Against the War, which has now renamed itself About Face, is very much a part of the leadership of this campaign. We are against these military adventures. They are wasteful. They are immoral, and they are a direct affront to what Dr. King was all about and what the Poor People's Campaign is all about. We are absolutely determined to make that integral, and are making it an integral part of our campaign. And on the night that war was launched, we were conducting trainings in nonviolent resistance. Our campaign is committed to nonviolence as a principle, and that means that we oppose the violence of the system with courageous, organized, and effective nonviolent direct action, moral fusion direct action. And you'll see as these things unfold what we have in mind. So I'm going to have to get going pretty soon, Robert, but I'm happy to have some others at some point come on your show and talk more specifically about what the plan is for the Poor People's Campaign. The Homeless Union absolutely supports and is part of the Poor People's Campaign. We had a major rally in Sacramento on Monday night. The place was packed. Trinity Cathedral with standing room only. We had speakers from the homeless unions. We had speakers from Black Lives Matter. We had speakers. We had the father-in-law, Stephon Clark, who was murdered by the Sacramento police.
Any anti-war speakers?
We had people from the Veterans for Peace. We had speakers that were addressing the issue of the militarization. That's another aspect of the war economy, is we've got an internal military now, with this increased militarization of the police departments.
Is anyone calling for a withdrawal of all troops from these countries?
Well, you know what? What we're trying to do is build a movement that has kind of these overarching themes. I mean, I think we've gotten in the habit in the social justice struggle of kind of compartmentalizing, having long lists of demands, long lists of we demand that withdrawal from this place, or the stopping this program, or defend this, and that's a necessary part of the fight. But the problem of it is that we have not amassed the power to actually enforce these demands, to actually impose our will on the government. And that's what Dr. King talked about. Dr. King talked about that the emphasis should not be on these individual programs and individualized demands, but on building a movement and instilling people with the self-confidence that they can impose these demands.
Yeah, but he called for a withdrawal.
The campaign has drafted a series of overarching national demands, which we're going to be rolling out
Right, but King did call for the withdrawal of troops from Vietnam, as far as I know. Maybe I'm mistaken about that. Are you calling? I mean, if you're not calling, if I should say we're not calling, because I'm in solidarity with what you're doing for the withdrawal of all troops from these countries, then saying that, oh, we're just waiting until we got enough power to do something, otherwise we're, you know, toothless tigers, I think is missing the clarity that you need to do when you're educating. But listen, you have spent twice as much time as you said you were going to. Would you like to give people...
All right. I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. But would you like to give people a website they can go to for more information about this campaign?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. They can go to poorpeoplescampaign.org, and there you will find plenty of information, videos, the fundamental principles, the documents, statements from the... we just had what was called, we call the Souls of Poor Folk, which is a national audit on these interconnected issues that was done by the Institute for Policy Studies and some other highly reputable data and think tanks. And that's there for people to read just to see just how bad it is. 147 million people now in poverty in the United States. It's 107 million more than were in poverty when King was assassinated in 1968. So, yes, all that's there at poorpeoplescampaign.org.
And that was Anthony Prince. It's possible I may make my way up to a meeting of that campaign he's working on in the next few days. It's not clear whether that's going to happen or not, but I'll be definitely following it on free radio and, who knows, doing what little I can down here. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. These shows archived on the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website at Huff Santa Cruz under the name Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, which is, of course, the name of the show. And under that, there's a subheading for Lost Shows. If you want to catch this show and earlier shows you may have missed for the last 6 months or so, check out this section called Lost Shows. Then there's a lot of earlier shows that are also available on that website. Interested in becoming a member of Free Radio Santa Cruz, that's a possibility too. All you got to do is give a call to me for more information. I'm not the boss of the station, but I am one of the broadcasters. And the number to call is the Huff number, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom's number, also my number, which is 423-HUFF, for all of you who still have literary dials. Also, it's 423-4833 for those of you who don't. And that's all, of course, in area code 831. And a reminder, we still have no studio to our name, and we're offering 500, maybe 600 bucks to the lucky person or, I don't know, hardworking person or knowledgeable person who finds us a place where we can keep the studio for a year, where we will pay rent. I mean, we really are up for paying between 300 and 400 bucks worth of rent per month to do that. We need a 10 by 10 space. We need access to electricity and internet and a bathroom somewhere rather than the bushes or a chamber pot. And you get your 600 bucks, which is, or let's say 500, because that's what we've agreed upon. But I think another member of the collective has just donated 100. You can also find out more about Free Radio by going to freakradio.org, which is the website for Free Radio. That's where you go if you want to listen to us. And it's also a place where there are schedules, some archives, information, application forms, and like that. Sample of Garfunkel and Oates, who are some singers I've just recently discovered. This is called the BJ song.
I've been down here such a long, long time. My neck is at a weird angle and I don't love the view. I've been working hard here, not sure what else to do. Maybe I'll try eye contact. Nope, no eye contact, I feel like a creep. Maybe it'll be over soon and I can go to... Ew, I just jagged a hate check. I did it again. Who is the first woman to put a dick in her mouth? So avant-garde, what a pioneer. God, I don't know anything about the history of women. If a hipster comes on someone's face, does he make it in a figure eight like little cum glasses? Pearl Vision. I wanna make you feel good. and stopping now would feel kind of wrong. I wanna make you feel good, but only if it doesn't take too long. What should I do? My mouth is so dry. Is it considered lubricant if I start to cry? If my dad saw me now, I would feel so bad. Oh my God, stop thinking about my dad. The length of time down here I'm willing to do is directly proportional to how much I like you. I feel like you should know that and hurry up, cause guess what? I don't like you that much. Or maybe I do. Who are you? I'm 36 years old and I forgot who I'm blowing. I can't be down here any longer with not knowing. You've got one of those dicks that I can't seem to place. I'll pretend to take a deep breath and look up at your face. Oh, it's Derek! I wanna make you feel good, and stopping now would feel kind of wrong. I wanna make you feel good, but only if it doesn't take too long. I feel like I haven't heard silence in such a long time. Is this the first time I've stopped talking in like 2 years? Am I talking to fill the void of the great big empty? Am I always like so I don't have to face my fears? Do I really need a dick in my mouth to stop talking? Don't I ever shut the fuck up? God, I'm so sick of myself. I need to talk to my therapist about why I talk so much. Am I scared of silence?
Yes, please call that. Yes, please call that. Yes, please call that. Yes, please call that.
I'm not sure I quite understood the ending of that song, but it's the BJ song by Garfunkel and Oates on their album Secretions. And it was put up on YouTube a couple years ago, September of 2015. A lot of their songs are on YouTube, or that's where I found them anyway. In fact, I was so amused, pleased, titillated, if you will, by their songs that I sent away for their album. Called Secretions, I guess it's called. There's another one too, which I don't know the name of. And this is another cut from the Food Not Bombs meal. It was actually Saturday a week ago on the 14th of April. That's when I had that interview with Anthony and Angela, who were dragged through or out of the sticker car in Taos, New Mexico. But here's a little more from Santa Cruz.
So we're talking with
Trayton Tyler.
Trayton, you say you find the war against the poor prominent here in Santa Cruz?
Not only prominent, but traumatizing. I'm 21 years old, and for the first time in my life, I've not really necessarily by choice, but both by happenstance and circumstance along with choice, become homeless in Santa Cruz. I came 276 miles from LAX 3 days ago, and the people I've met that are homeless have been 1,000 times nicer than the people I've met that aren't, except for the people here like yourself, sir. I didn't know your name, but I'm Trayton.
I'm Robert.
Robert, it's a pleasure to meet you. But man, what I wanted to say was Food Not Bombs and programs like that in places like Santa Cruz should be started in places like Syria. Because we don't even teach enough languages in our school. I speak fluently 3 languages, and I wouldn't even call it fluent.
3 languages being?
English, French, and Spanish, sir. Arabic, is it that they speak in Syria?
Yes.
And not Arabic. Among other things, I don't speak Farsi or Arabic. But I would love to learn, and there's nowhere here to learn because people are so, so worried about bombs and not worried about the people eating food. And that's really all I have to say, sir. Thank you for your time.
We've been talking with
Trayton Tyler from Santa Cruz.
Thank you, Trayton.
Actually, Hawaii, but Santa Cruz is like a second home. Thank you, guys.
Fair enough. Thank you, Trayton.
And then the next day, because Food Not Bombs has meals Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6, at the main post office, I came back to the Food Not Bombs meal, partially because there was, of course, bombing of Syria on Friday, Saturday. Was it Friday or Saturday? Friday evening or Saturday morning. I guess it was Friday evening. And I was concerned with, I don't know, screaming about Syria. And really concerned about World War III and pissed what was going on. Now it's been a few days later, and everything seems to be quieting down, mainly because the mainstream media is probably quieting down. But Food Not Bombs threw a rally for peace down at the post office, and here's some audio from that.